Thanks for joining us for New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, and Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is A. John Simmons. He's the author of a fantastic new book titled Boundaries of Authority, which is published by Oxford University Press. As I suspect many listeners will know, John has been working on normative questions about state authority for quite some time. This latest book explores normative issues regarding the moral rights of states with respect to territory. Now, there are several questions here, questions about borders, immigration and exclusion, natural resources in, under, and above the ground, and so on. And many of these are taken up by John in the book. But before we get into the details of Boundaries of Authority, let's greet our guest. Hi, John.
Good morning, Bob.
How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us on New Books in Philosophy.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk a bit about the book. These issues are important ones, I think, and I hope that people will be stimulated to do their own work on the problems.
Great. Before we get into the problems and the way that you address them in the book, why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Right. Well, I was born in the United States and have lived here my whole life, with the exception of a few semesters spent abroad. I was born in New Jersey specifically and lived all up and down the East Coast. My philosophical interests developed perhaps somewhat later in life than is true for many of us. I had no interest in philosophy in high school, and I entered college as an engineer, taking almost exclusively math and science classes, though it gradually dawned on me that my favorite classes were the electives that were outside of the engineering curriculum. My interest in philosophy began when I took an undergraduate class at Princeton from Tim Scanlon. I think the class was called Systematic Ethics. And while I did many other things during my undergraduate years, I was hooked on philosophy and ended up pursuing that as a major. It was a terrific time to do philosophy at Princeton. I had the opportunity to take classes with Hempel and Blastos, with Donald Davidson, with Stuart Hampshire, Walter Kaufman, Dick Rorty. I worked a lot with Tim Scanlon while I was there. My undergraduate thesis, which all Princeton undergraduates have to write, was directed by Tom Nagel. So I got some really excellent philosophical training that decided me to try my hand at graduate school. I went to graduate school at Cornell, where I worked primarily with Nick Sturgeon and David Lyons. David Lyons supervised my dissertation there, which after a couple of years of work became my first book on political obligation. I was offered a job out of graduate school at the University of Virginia, which I took, and I have been there ever since for more than 40 years. I've been perhaps tempted to leave a few times by offers that I've received elsewhere, but the University of Virginia is a very fine university. I enjoy the students there, and I love Charlottesville. So I've remained, and here I am now.
That's great. Interesting, maybe philosophically, that you've stayed put, that you've taken up residence within a particular location and haven't moved. Does that seem like a philosophical?
It might well be.
You have some allegiance to a particular dare I say, state. Great. Let's move on to the book. The book begins with a chapter that discusses what you call some necessary preliminaries. And you're centrally concerned to introduce their the broader themes and issues concerning political authority, particularly with respect to authority over persons or individuals. I guess that some of this that I'm about to ask you to run us through will be familiar to some readers, but I still think it would be good to hear you lay it out. Can you begin us off with just some of the general preliminary issues about authority?
Right. Well, the subject of the book, as you've said, is political authority and the relationship between state or governmental claims to authority over a particular set of persons and the claims that states or governments make to authority over particular territories. Political authority in this sense, in the great early modern treatises in political philosophy, was usually contrasted with divine authority, the authority of God over God's creatures, and over God's creations, over the earth and over persons and lower animals. And it was contrasted as well, typically, with paternal or parental authority, the authority of parents over their children. Political authority, I understand, in the way that I suppose it's understood by most contemporary political philosophers, political authority understood this way is a moral right of a state or a government to rule over persons and territory, or perhaps more accurately, to exercise jurisdiction over persons and territories. That way of thinking of political authority contrasts with a way that might be familiar to readers from the discussions of political authority that you'll find in some works in political science, where authority is taken to be an empirical property rather than a moral property of regimes. In this case, authority is thought to be to consist in or to be measured by the levels of popular support that particular regimes manage to acquire. There is no real discussion of that way of thinking of authority in the book. That is, I don't discuss how it is that particular kinds of leaders or particular kinds of governments manage to attract popular support. I'm interested in the normative dimension of politics. This way of thinking about authority also contrasts, I suppose, with a kind of authority with which philosophers often contrast it, with the kind of authority that is claimed or possessed by experts within a particular domain, what's sometimes called epistemic authority. The claims of authorities of that sort provide us with reasons to believe what they say. The claims of practical authorities seem rather different. Practical authorities, and we might use in addition as examples, in addition to political authority, the authority that parents are thought to have over their children, or perhaps that employers are thought to have over their employees, the claims of practical authorities give us distinctive sorts of reasons to act rather than reasons to believe what they say. While we might hope that our practical authorities were experts in some domain, they're authority does not consist in or is not necessarily tied to such expertise. In the case of practical authority, what we have is distinctive sorts of reasons to act. And typically, in the case of practical authority, these reasons amount to moral obligations. So in the case of practical political authority, authority is thought to consist in the right of authorities to rule and the correlative moral obligation on the part of subjects to comply with the commands or the legal requirements set by those authorities and to support the political authorities in other ways beyond simple obedience. Now, as I've said, the book concerns the interrelation between arguments concerning political authority over persons and political authority over territories. Territories obviously can't have moral obligations to act. We might say that political authority of persons consists in the right of the authority to specify the duties of those persons. That can't be the nature of political authority over territories. Typically, political authority over territories is understood to be the moral right to control how people will act with respect to those territories, with respect to the land and resources that the land contains or consists in. And so the political authority over territories will, for instance, give the state the right to impose a certain legal property regime, to establish certain kinds of control over the borders of the territory, and so on. The standard approaches to the justification of political authority over sets of persons almost always are taken to imply justifications for states' control over territories, over land and resources, specifically the land and resources that are lived on and used by the people over whom the state has authority. The nature of the implication here from the implication of arguments for political authority over persons to arguments for political authority over territories differs from theory to theory, but all the major theories seem to think there is one. As a longstanding skeptic about political authority of existing states over persons, I am predictably, I suppose, in the book, skeptical about, as well, about political authority over territories, though I do in the book defend one account that I think gives plausible explanations for how both political authority over persons and political authority over territories could be justified. This is, again, predictably, I suppose, a Lockean account. The account, of course, doesn't end up justifying the claims of actual states over actual sets of persons or actual territories that they claim, but it provides, I claim, a plausible ideal towards which we can try to move in practical political affairs. So the body of the book, it's probably fair to say, consists in contrasting that kind of Lockean approach to questions about political authority over persons and territories with what I take to be the dominant strain of thought in contemporary political philosophy, which is broadly Kantian or Rawlsian.
Excellent. Maybe if there's time later, there might not be. I would like to ask the methodological question that you just prompted about the ideal nature of the theorizing
right.
in the book, but let's see if we can get there. That's something that gets discussed throughout the book. I take it, though, it's not a major theme. Again, I take it that some of our listeners will be aware of one of your influential essays on the ideal non-ideal distinction. So maybe we'll get back to that. Let's though take up sort of where the book begins after the preliminaries, which is with an argument that's early on your agenda that a state's claim to have authority over its citizens can be negatively impacted or diminished or maybe defeated by historical wrongdoings by the state. That is, that it looks as if one of the first things that you're interested in on your way towards addressing these questions about borders is also to look at how the past can affect present authority relations. And here you offer a very compelling, I thought, analysis of Thoreau and civil disobedience. Can you tell us a little bit about what you find intriguing about Thoreau's line on this?
Sure. Well, as anyone who's ever read Thoreau knows, Thoreau was not a systematic philosopher. And I confess my acquaintance with Thoreau is relatively recent. I remembered enough of Thoreau, though, to think that I might find in Thoreau a position that contrasts with the Rawlsian approach to civil disobedience. Rawls' writings on civil disobedience are what we all discuss when we teach civil disobedience, at least it's certainly what I discuss. Thoreau is generally read, I think, as being pretty moderate, his arguments as being broadly in line with Rawlsian arguments. The standard reading of Thoreau, I think, has him saying something like that it's permissible to quietly or civilly disobey laws that are unjust, or to disobey the law where legal obedience would support unjust policies. So Thoreau's tax resistance, for instance, is permissible provided that it's civil. So this sounds not too unlike Rawls. There is a slightly more radical reading of Rousseau that is abroad in the of Thoreau, sorry, that is abroad in the literature on Thoreau, that the United States in Thoreau's day had delegitimated itself by engaging in massively unjust policies regarding the institution of human slavery, regarding the aggressive war against Mexico, and regarding the treatment of Native American peoples. When one reads Thoreau carefully, one finds Thoreau saying things that are rather stronger than this and more radical. One kind of thing that he says is that political authority depends on the consent of the governed, and that consent is absent in the case of Thoreau and maybe absent in the case of many others. And the other radical thing that he seems to say is that the very idea of political authority seems to conflict with our obligation to, as Bob Wolfe puts it 100 years later, to exercise our autonomy, that is, to act in whatever way we think is best in the circumstances. What these more radical views suggest is that state illegitimacy is not just about the justice or injustice of state policies or the institutional structure of states. It suggests a more radical picture of Thoreau as a kind of philosophical anarchist. Now, the lesson that I try to draw from the discussion of Thoreau is to see the justification of legal disobedience in slightly different terms than the Rawlsian or the Comtean wants to see them. For Rawls, the justification for legal disobedience is, we might say, structural. That is, it's based on the current character of the basic structure of society, its fundamental legal, political, and economic institutions. If injustice within the basic structure is limited, Rawls seems to say, then disobedience is either impermissible altogether or must be civil, that is, aimed at a repair of the basic structure. If the injustice in the basic structure is extensive enough, then we might say all bets are off. Rawls' theory only applies to near just political society, so the theory, as it were, runs out at that point. The contrast that I find in Thoreau is the claim that it's not just structural injustice, that is, injustice in the basic structure of society, that can justify disobedience, but rather historical wrongs of various kinds that can justify disobedience. Even structurally just institutions can be, and indeed have been, wrongly imposed on people, such as the descendants of slaves and Native Americans. So the claim here seems to me to be that history matters to justifications of disobedience, not just the current character of the basic structure of our society. So what I try to do here is contrast what I call internal or structural limits to political authority, the kinds of limits emphasized by Rawls and by contemporary Rawlsians and Kantians, and contrast those with what I call external or historical limits to political authority based on the wrongful subjection by states of persons or territories. For Rawlsians, Kantians, doing justice for people or making justice possible for people is what gives states their authority over them, over those people and over the territories on which they live. It's what gives states the moral right to exercise jurisdiction that I was talking about a moment ago. Mm-hmm. But justice in this tradition is purely about the present and the future, not about how states came to control the particular sets of people and the parts of the physical universe over which they claim authority. And given the rather dark and bloody histories of most states' acquisitions of their territories and sets of subjects, and given the fact that claims about wrongful subjection and historical illegitimacy are familiar from our everyday actual political lives, it seems at least initially odd to me to suppose that current states' claims to moral rights over persons and territory are in no way affected by the moral character of their histories of acquisition of persons and persons as subjects and territories as their own.
Excellent. Now that that contrast you were just drawing between your reading of Thoreau and Rawls, and then as you characterized it, Rawls slash Kantian views, helps us to sort of then transition into the boundary issues that you're most interested in. And so let's just pick up there. One of the central foils and recurring foils that you employ in the book is a view, or maybe it's a family of views, called Kantian functionalism. Can you fill in a little bit about, in a little bit more detail than what you've already done, about what the functionalist view is, particularly addressing why you think it doesn't give us a good entry into the issues about boundaries that you're concerned with?
Right. The term functionalist isn't mine. I think Annie Stiltz used it to describe the contemporary Kantian position. The basic idea of functionalism is that states' authority derives from the state's successful performance of its morally required function. And in the hands of Kantians and Rawlsians, that morally required function is the doing of justice within a domain. As we'll all remember, I suspect, Rawls suggests that we all have a natural duty of justice, that is, a natural duty to comply with and support those just institutions that exist and that apply to us. So the sort of de jure authority of governments and states is, on this view, explained in terms of the de facto reach of governmental institutions in the administration of justice. One of the examples that I trot out periodically in the book to try to challenge this approach to questions about political authority is the example of the United States surreptitiously moving its border barriers. I'm inspired to use this example by Thoreau's worries about the Mexican War, but we could imagine a near just political society, or even a perfectly just political society in terms of its structure, the basic structure of the society, its fundamental institutions, that nonetheless behaved aggressively in the following way. It moved its border barriers south, claimed the newly enclosed territory as its own and the newly enclosed subjects as its subjects, guaranteed them all of the same rights that our basic legal and political institutions guarantee to all American citizens, and then proceeded as if nothing had happened. Now, my suspicion is that most people would think that there's something wrong with this, and indeed most Rawlsians and Kantians agree that there's something wrong with this. What it appears that they can't agree with, without changing their position in a fairly dramatic way, is that the mere application of just institutions to individuals is sufficient to justify claims of political authority over subjects and territories. It seems to me that a natural response to examples of this sort is that the United States does not have legitimate authority over the newly acquired, illegitimately acquired citizens and territories, but it's not clear how the Kantian position can recognize this kind of limit to political authority, given its insistence that it's the mere de facto reach of just political institutions. What's unclear to me is how Rawlsians or Kantians can consistently acknowledge that wrongful subjection of the sort that seems to be at issue in the Mexico example that I've just cited, how they can explain that this in any way limits the political authority of states over persons and territories. I take it that the natural response is that the newly enclosed Mexican citizens and the newly enclosed Mexican territory are not subject to American jurisdiction in the same way that long-standing American citizens and territories are subject to it, but it's not clear how the Rawlsian or the Kantian can maintain that, given the claim that it is the de facto reach of just institutions that determines the scope or the extent of political authority. So one of the things I do in the chapter in which I discuss this boundary problem is look at the other possible resources available to contemporary Kantians to address this problem. So I look at the theories of, say, Scott Shapiro and Tom Cristiano, the theories of democratic authority, in which they essentially claim that it is arrogant or dictatorial for people to refuse to do their part within fair cooperative schemes. My suggestion there is that even fair terms of cooperation, even just political institutions, don't appear to be mandatory to people who are wrongfully subjected to the dominion of those institutions. I also look at some claims by Dave Estland concerning political authority as the doing of an urgent task, and my response is similar in that case. It looks to me as if existing states with de jure authority over their territory, their claimed territories and subjects, is the starting point of Kantian theory. It's a presumption of Kantian theory that's not open to question. The real question for Kantians and Rawlsians is what political institutions must look like in order to be just, in order for that political authority to be maintained. This seems to me to make such theories blind to the significance of the moral, the historical dimension of political life, which I take to be an important moral dimension. I should emphasize, I suppose, that while a lot of the book is critical of Rawlsian political philosophy, I'm in fact an admirer of Rawlsian political philosophy. I think that most of what Rawls has to say about the idea of justice is eminently plausible. What I think is wrong with Rawlsian political philosophy is that it attempts to extend those ideas about justice to yield a theory of political authority over persons and territories. And it seems to me that those two dimensions of political philosophy need to be carefully separated and require separate treatment. I've emphasized in other work that I've done the distinction between what I call justification and legitimacy, which I take to be independent evaluative dimensions in political philosophy. I think states can be evaluated in terms of their justifying virtues, which is what I think Rawlsian political philosophy is most relevant to, and they can be evaluated in terms of the legitimacy of their claims to authority over persons and territories. And it's on that latter question that I think Rawlsians and Kantians overreach.
Excellent. So let's turn to then the issues about territorial rights by states. So you consider a trio of popular views in the literature that stand in contrast to your own view, which is a kind of Lockean individualist voluntarist view. The three foils are again the functionalist view, and then there's a nationalist view with respect to states and their rights to territory, and then a voluntarist view that has got a kind of collective or majoritarian aspect. Can you run us through again, particularly I suppose the newcomers, the nationalist view and the majoritarian voluntarist views. Can you run us through these different views about territorial rights?
Right. So all of these theories obviously have accounts of how it is that states can acquire legitimate authority over persons. So here in this chapter, at the start of the second part of the book, what I'm trying to do is look at the extensions of those theories to cover the idea of authority to control particular territories. So on the functionalist view, as I've just said, the thought is that controlling territory is necessary for states to perform the morally imperative tasks that states perform. And the functionalist view, as I understand it, could be either the kind of Kantian view that I've discussed in the previous two chapters, or it could be a consequentialist view of some sort, according to which the morally mandatory function of the state is producing happiness or preference satisfaction or whatever you might identify as the consequential end. So there, to be perfectly clear, the idea is that in the same way that controlling persons is necessary for states to do justice or to produce happiness, controlling territories is necessary as well. The two newcomer theories that I consider there are the majoritarian or plebiscitary voluntarist view that is defended by Kit Wellman and Andy Altman in their book, whose title is something about a liberal theory of international justice, I think. I've forgotten the precise title. And according to that kind of voluntarist view, the states controlling a particular territory is necessary for us to respect a group's choice to be a self-determining group. So it's the value of political choice, as it were, which is supposed to account both for the authority of groups over individuals, the fact that they've chosen to form self-determining groups, and to account for the rights of states to control the territories on which those groups live. The nationalist position is slightly harder to summarize succinctly. Nations, of course, the concept of a nation is somewhat controversial, and different nationalists give slightly different accounts of what that amounts to, but we all have, I guess, a rough and ready idea of what a nation is. And the idea here is that nations are frequently attached to particular territories, their homelands, say, that nations themselves are morally valuable, and that membership in a nation is something morally valuable that ought to be preserved. The associative ties between members of a nation depend on their having control over the territory in which they live. The preservation of their national identities is importantly tied to their control over particular territories. And so the idea is that the value of nationhood, as it were, extends to the importance of to show the rights that nations have to control particular territories. I actually do sort of contrast these three views as well as my own sort of Lockean individualist view, the view that I prefer and defend later in the book, to the cosmopolitan view, perhaps most familiar from the work of Thomas Poga. And while cosmopolitans like Poga seem seldom to challenge the accounts that these theories give of the jurisdictional rights of states, that is, their rights to control particular districted sets of persons, cosmopolitans tend to be very critical of these theories' claims with regard to states' robust territorial rights. A familiar feature of views like Poga's is that states have no strong rights to control their borders, that is, to prevent unwanted immigration, that they have no strong rights to control the resources that happen to be located within their territorial boundaries. So the cosmopolitan position essentially denies what the other theories I'm considering here affirm, namely that there can be a moral justification for states to exercise robust control over their borders, robust control over resources. Territorial rights that I suggest in the book are more property-like and less jurisdictional in nature.
Right, right. Can you run us through then how your individualist Lockean position runs, particularly with respect to some of the issues you discuss a little bit later in the book as you develop your positive view, including rights of supersession and resource rights?
Right. So the problem of rights supersession is one that I emphasize in my criticism of all of the sort of rival views of territorial rights. It seems to me that the standard position in almost all of these theories is that we need some way of explaining why the unjust histories of states don't call for rectification rather than for the maintenance of states' current claims to control over territories. That is, almost all actual states have established their control over particular territories and sets of persons by aggressive conquest. It's certainly true in the United States that much of the United States was acquired through aggressive conquest. And the question is why the older territorial rights of individuals who lived on the land and seemed to have the same kind of relation to the land that we currently have now don't persist in the face of these wrongful conquests and call for rectification of those wrongs, why we think it is that states have sort of undiminished or robust rights of territorial control over territories that they've come by in these illegitimate ways. The supersession thesis essentially says that the older rights of prior residents, prior groups, fade away with the passage of time to be replaced by the rights of those who have occupied the territories that were formerly occupied by those groups. That always has struck me as a suspicious move, the idea that that we can simply ignore historical wrongs because they've faded away.
And, like the photographs or something, right?
That's right. Sometimes it's compared to the supersession thesis in Waldron, for instance, who's the most prominent defender of this view and the one who actually suggested the language of supersession to discuss these problems in. He compares this doctrine of the fading of territorial rights to legal doctrines of acquisitive prescription, like doctrines governing adverse possession in the law. What makes the move look somewhat suspicious is that while we can understand good reasons why there might be legal doctrines like adverse possession, good administrative reasons, as it were, where we lose the kind of evidence of wrongful acquisition that might be necessary to make a case in a court of law, it's seems considerably less plausible than that when we're talking about the moral rights of states to control over territory, that the same kinds of administrative arguments would be available. And so Waldron has to offer different arguments for the supersession thesis, which perhaps we'll get to later. You asked me, though, to compare the three views that I criticize at the beginning of the second part of the book, the nationalist and functionalist and majoritarian voluntarist view, with the view that I defend, which is, as you have rightly said, an individualist voluntarist view. So I also think, like the majoritarian voluntarists, that territorial rights turn importantly on the value of choice, political choice, in the case of an individual voluntarist position like Locke's, political obligation, the state's authority over persons, is derived from the actual personal consent of those individuals who are subject to state authority. And the state's authority of over land derives from the submission of land to which individuals have prior property or occupancy rights to the state's jurisdiction. No actual states in the world come even close to meeting this model. Actual states all include many people who are not sort of willing, consenting members of the political societies, and states make territorial claims to parts of the world that have in no way been freely submitted to the state. And for defending the Lockean theory, is not that it can provide us with a non-revisionist account of the actual moral rights that states have to control persons and territories. What I take to be compelling about the Lockean theory is the ideal theory that it defends. It captures straightforwardly, I think, the intuition that many of us possess, that many of us subscribe to, that claims to territorial rights are most compelling where the territories in question are lived on and used by willing subjects of the states. Where we are most skeptical, I believe, about states' claims to territorial rights are either where the persons living on those territories have been forcibly subjected, or where the territories are claimed without any actual use by willing members of the political community. What I think this kind of ideal theory of territorial rights preserves, importantly, is the particularity of territorial claims. Mm. That is, we can understand in a straightforward way why the particular territories that states claim are the ones over which they have authority, because those territories are the ones on which the willing members of the community live and labor. This theory also eliminates the need for a supersession thesis. On the Lockean ideal theory, wrongs that states have done in acquiring authority over individuals and territories simply require rectification. Theory is not committed to there being a potential problem with trapped minorities, because unwilling persons who are sort of within the territories claimed by states are simply not subject to legitimate state coercion, and the lands on which they live and labor are not subject to the territorial jurisdiction of the state. So I think the ideal theory captures certain important intuitions that we have about territorial rights. It identifies a target of fully rightful, legitimate territorial claims by states. It identifies the most serious kinds of wrongs that states can do in their quests to acquire authority over persons and territories. Then what non-ideal theory will have to do for us is identify the best ways to rectify those kinds of wrongs. I mean, non-ideal theory here won't be neat. Non-ideal theory is not neat for any kind of political philosophy, not just Lockean political philosophy. But I don't think the sloppiness of non-ideal theory is a particular problem for the view.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about the, particularly about the resource rights? I found that some of the discussion of the sort of history of thinking about how deep into the earth resources can go and how far into the sky a state's claim to jurisdiction can go, very interesting.
Right. I distinguish in the discussion of resource rights, I treat resource claims by states as a kind of property-like claim that states make. The kinds of claims that states actually make and the kinds of claims that are enforceable under international law are really fairly extraordinary in certain ways. I distinguish between the sort of core claims, as I call them, that states make, which are the claims to a certain bounded area of surface, land, and water, and the resources on that land. I contrast those with what we might call the extended territorial claims that states make, claims to the air above the state, to the subsurface below the state, to water such as coastal waters around the state. And I look a little bit at some of the historical debate. It's a very brief discussion of the historical debates between Hugo Grotius and Selden and Pufendorf concerning the ownership of the sea and the worries that they had about the fact that the sea constantly changes its constitution. Mm-hmm. The same kind of thing that we could say about the air and the subsurface as we now understand the subsurface to work. But the claims that states are entitled to under international law in these areas are the air up to wherever we take outer space to begin, which is not settled in international law. The
it seems hard to settle as a philosophical matter. It would just, I mean, it seems right. Like a, it seems like a not a well-formed question, actually.
In a way, I think that's correct. In fact, the position I argue for is that the rights that states should be understood to have in the extended domain in air, subsurface, and sea look to be rights that can only be justified if the exercise of those rights is necessary for a state's legitimate activities on their core claims to bounded land. So what I suggest is that legitimate activities that we can imagine might be traffic control in the air or on the sea, border control, the guarding of the border and the administration of state policies with regard to what passes over the border, and national defense. If we understand the state's legitimate extended claims in that way, most states claim territories that extend far beyond what could be justified in those terms. Indeed, it's not even clear how we could understand a state's claims to the deep subsurface of the earth. I also think that claims to resources on the ocean floor, claims to exclusive economic zones extending far off the coast, and so on, are simply indefensible. And that none of the familiar theories of territorial rights, the ones that I've summarized and criticized earlier in the book, can actually give an account of how states territorial claims are sufficiently robust to extend to those kinds of things.
Great. Can we, I wanted to make sure that we get into the issue that I'm sure a lot of people who might just run across the book on a shelf in a bookstore, if there are such things any longer, by the way, you say boundaries of authority. I'm wondering if the casual reader might not look at that book and think it's about immigration.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about the right to exclude?
Right. So I take the standard views in the existing philosophical literature on immigration to be two, roughly. One view amounts to a defense of discretionary rights of self-determination in matters of immigration, defended in a variety of ways. Kit Wellman, for instance, defends such discretionary rights in terms of the associational rights, the associational freedom of self-governing polities. David Miller defends discretionary self-determination in these matters in terms of what's necessary for cultural preservation within national groups. That's on one side of the debate. On the other side of the debate is the open borders position that's most familiar from the work of Joe Kerens, which attacks the idea that states have discretionary rights of self-determination in immigration matters. Most of the open borders arguments rest on roughly Rawlsian looking arguments. Rawls himself, of course, did not extend his arguments to justify claims that borders ought to be open or at least very permeable. But the idea of nationality as a morally arbitrary feature of our lives, that we're simply dropped into the world as members of this nation or that, and that which nation we happen to be dropped into determines in dramatic ways our life prospects, is the sort of underlying basis for a lot of open border arguments, that it's simply not fair that we be restricted in that way by our social starting point, which is arbitrary from the moral point of view. I find that the open borders arguments are primarily persuasive only because they presume without argument that there are not any natural rights to control territories that individuals can possess and that individuals can transfer to their political groups. And of course, it's natural rights to control property and subsequently state rights to control national territory that are the guiding idea in the Lockean position that I defend. So I try to defend a kind of intermediate position between these two views, one that holds that in a legitimate society, a society that's legitimate by Lockean terms, that there are, in fact, reasonable discretionary rights of exclusion based on the fact that the individuals have property claims and states have property-like claims to the territories in question, though there are all sorts of limits to this discretionary right based on duties to assist the unfortunate. So the position that I end up defending in the chapter is, I'd say, something like an intermediate view between the two dominant views that are defended in the literature today.
Fantastic. You've been very generous with your time. So one last question. What will your next project look like?
Well, I've been working on a couple of papers on colonialism. There's been a sort of emerging literature on what's wrong with colonialism. And I'm interested in talking about colonialism in light of some of the arguments that I actually make in this book. I mean, one of the examples I use in the book concerns the requirements on the hunter-gatherer groups who utilize large territories for their lifestyles, the requirements on them to downsize their holdings, their claims in the face of new people, new generations of people that need access to territories. So I think some of the literature on colonialism can be illuminated by appeal to those kinds of arguments, and that's what I'm working on now. Whether that will amount to anything of interest remains to be seen.
I'm sure it will. It's been wonderful talking to you about your new book, Boundaries of Authority. Thank you for your time today, John.
Well, thank you very much, Bob, for the opportunity to talk about this.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us on New Books in Philosophy. Again, the book is titled Boundaries of Authority. The author is A. John Simmons. The book is published by Oxford University Press. I encourage everyone to go out and check it out. Bye for now.